This is Digital Story Podcast number 1063, August 4th, 2026. Today's theme is the most important new camera feature. I'm Derek Story. Is there a single feature that drives your decision when considering a new camera? That one thing that is a go, no-go factor. I know what mine is, but I was curious about the thoughts from those in our community. So I asked them, and in the first segment of today's TDS Photography Podcast, I share what they have to say. I hope you enjoy the show. So before I get to the comments themselves, I have a graph in the show notes. You know, so it's a poll, so we get the graphical view, so you get an overview of what's going on, and then we have the comments that go with that overview. The reason why I came up with this idea for this week was because I've been thinking about the features that drove my latest camera investment. It was really clear the things that I wanted, and then the things that I knew I couldn't live without. And it got me thinking, well, what about the preferences of others? So I decided to find out by asking the question to our Inner Circle community, when considering a new camera, what is the number one feature at the top of your priority list? All right, so let's go with the multiple choices. I gave them 5 multiple choices, and then, of course, they chimed in with the comments. So at the top of the list that I put, and this isn't in terms of what they voted for. This is just in, you know, the order that I listed them. I put image resolution, megapixels, at the very top. And 7% chose that. So megapixels, image resolution, the thing that camera manufacturers have been hanging their hat on for years, with our audience, is not that high. Only 7% have that as their priority feature. Second, below that, again, not in terms of response, but just in terms of my listing it, high ISO performance, low light capability. 3% on that one. So high ISO performance, which is another thing that many camera manufacturers tout, again, low in our community. The third one, body size. Bigger okay or smaller is best, 30% on this one. So 30% of our respondents said that body size is a top priority when considering a new camera. That doesn't surprise me because, you know, this audience has a lot of Micro Four Thirds users, a lot of compact camera users, a lot of mirrorless cameras that are, you know, pretty portable. You know, even the Sonys, the cameras themselves are portable. It depends on what lenses you put on them. But body size is a big time consideration in this audience, 30%. Brand loyalty, support those who got you there. Now, this was 15%, but as you'll hear in the comments, brand loyalty does come into play, maybe not always as the top priority, but in terms of your lenses. So if you have a half a dozen Olympus lenses or a half a dozen Sony lenses or whatever mount you happen to be using, that does create a stickiness that carries over when you're thinking about a new camera body, because you are going to at least initially investigate cameras that allow you to use the lenses you already have. Now, sometimes people just go, hey, I'm going to change brands altogether. I'm going to sell all this stuff and get something different. That does happen. But it's interesting that brand loyalty does come into play here. 15% as a top priority, but it's a higher percentage as a consideration. And then the fifth one, something else. And I just said, put your something else in the comments. And that's exactly what they did, 42% something else. So again, this tells us that with our audience, they're not going to just say, hey, this is the one thing That is my top priority. I think it's more nuanced than that. And we're going to hear that now in the comments. So let's get over to those. Here's the first one. I think this is like being asked, what's the best camera? The highest priority is that the new camera exists in a niche I can justify filling with a new camera, given all the cameras I already own. The size of the required niche diminishes proportionally with time. It's maybe something we don't want to admit to, but how it looks and feels is really important, especially if you are a collector. And that was Andrew H. that contributed that. I'm really glad that he brought up how it looks and feels, because that's important to me also. And is definitely a consideration. As you'll find out later on, it's not my top consideration, but it is a contributing factor. And I like cameras that look good. I really do. And I'm not ashamed to say that at all. So anyway, let's go on to the next one. A viewfinder of some sort is a must-have for me. I find value in a rear panel LCD for sure, but I don't want it as my only means of composing. And that was by Jim K. I feel strongly about that as well. All right, here's what Dave has to say, Dave K. The number one feature that I look for is image quality, which is a combination of dynamic range and megapixels. I will trade away megapixels to get better shadow detail and high dynamic range images. And that was by Dave. And image quality, which is, you know, a lot of times what you would think would be the starting point for most people. The problem, I think, these days is, and it's not a problem at all, it's a blessing, really, is that the image quality is pretty darn good across all the brands. So, you know, before, I think, you know, back in the earlier days, definitely some cameras had better IQ than others. These days, especially in good light, I think image quality is it's a horse race. It's a horse race for sure. Speaking of which, here's what Rob had to say. At this point, all cameras are pretty good in good light. High ISO performance is often the kicker for me, and that's why I use larger sensor cameras. In other words, yes, in good light, it's hard to find a bad camera these days. But when you're in challenging conditions, then, and if you find yourself in challenging conditions a lot, then that's a feature, you know, how that camera can perform in those challenging conditions. In low light, can it give you enough shutter speed to do what you need to do, even if you don't have a really wide aperture lens? So I can definitely see that depending on the type of shooting that you're doing. Here's what Larry B. had to say. Even though megapixels and IQ are important, I would have a tough time changing out thousands of dollars in glass. There would have to be a real good reason to switch, and I really don't see myself buying into a third lens system. And that was Larry B. on that one. This is that brand loyalty that I was talking about. It manifests itself often through our optics, through our lenses. Right now, I'm using an OM-1 that works well for my needs. I did not upgrade to the OM-1 Mark II because the change, in my opinion, did not justify the investment. If a new model features justifies the investment, I will strongly consider an upgrade. I would not consider another camera brand, as I have the OM lenses that I really like and they work well for me. And that was Larry A. on that one that commented that. And again, brand loyalty really kind of coming through the lenses more than the brand itself, so to speak. Larry likes his OM-1 a lot, but what he really likes are his lenses that go on the OM-1, and that is a driving force for him. I have another Larry for you. I have a Larry M. Even though I checked the megapixel box, these are all important. Brand loyalty is a given. I do not wish to reinvest in glass either. Brand loyalty through optics. Here's what Henry H. had to say. Good new features are huge, but I'm also looking for a familiar interface so that years of my finger memory don't go to waste. I guess that could go under brand loyalty, but it's not a brand loyalty. When I switched from Canon to Sony 11 years ago, it was based on image quality. I put up with an inferior user experience to gain noticeable improvement in my images. Fortunately, that's less of an issue nowadays. And again, that was Henry H. Here's what Jeff A. had to say. I agree with Tim and Andrew. It all depends. I'm not brand loyal other than the expense of the new lenses. When I went to mirrorless, I only had a few options because neither Canon nor Nikon was playing in that sandbox yet. I checked out Olympus and Sony, but I decided I liked the feel and retro dials that Fuji was offering. Moving forward, keeping everything smaller will be a big factor if I think about changing. That was Jeff A. Here's what Charlie W. had to say. I clicked body size to indicate smaller is better. My old EPL5 plus removable VF4 electronic viewfinder was probably the most enjoyable size I've owned, even nicer than the Pen F. My OM5 has been pretty good so far in the size and has better autofocus. I have the Moab workshop coming up in October. Should I consider different equipment? Would the 40 megapixel Fuji XE5 be better fit for the landscape? I plan to resist the temptation and instead hone my craft. Learning a whole new system at the last minute seems unwise. The OM5's high res mode, 50 or 80 megapixels, is not bad fit for landscape challenge. And I've had great results by stitching up to 20 telephoto images. Overkill for printing, but fun to zoom in on. Again, that was Charlie W. on that one. Okay, so those are some interesting thoughts there, some really well thought out opinions. And I think the lens collection really does come into play with this sort of thing. As I said before, at the top of this feature, that megapixels just aren't the player that they used to be. I think now user experience is very important. You know, body size, how the camera looks, how the camera feels. These seem to be the things that are sort of bubbling up to the top. As for me, well, at the top of the list is body size as well. If the camera and lens get left home because they're too big, then I'm not going to get the return on my investment that I want. In other words, the cameras that I shoot with these days, unless it's a special occasion, but just my everyday cameras, the cameras that I carry with me for 80% of the photography that I do, they need to be portable. They need to be light. They need to be able to hang around my neck for a couple hours. They need to fit in my backpack. And I need to have the versatility of a few lenses or a single zoom lens, you know, that covers most of the things that I want to shoot, but in a compact package. So body size for me is super important, and it's at the top of my list still. Going down my list a bit, second is an electronic viewfinder. If I want to compose off an LCD, I might as well use my iPhone, which is a pretty darn good camera. But I just think it's very difficult to always be composing off an LCD. I run into this problem with my TG7, which is probably the only camera that I have that does not have an electronic viewfinder. And that's because it's a specialty camera. As Andrew would say, it fills a niche and it fills it very well. But generally speaking, for a camera that I'm going to carry with me all the time, I need an electronic viewfinder, and I'm not going to compose just off the LCD. And speaking of LCDs, and this is something that really swung me on the L10, is that it needs to be articulating. Either needs to be able to flip up and down, or it needs to swing out and be fully articulated. But I need something so that I can hold the camera up over my head and compose, hold the camera down at my ankles without getting down on the ground and compose, and then other angles too. And, you know, one of the reasons why I never bought LX100. I reviewed them, you know, I wrote reviews on them, but they were cameras that were lent to me for review. The reason why I never bought one was that fixed back LCD. It just, especially in a compact camera, it just isn't versatile enough for me. The fully articulating LCD is third on my list. So for me, it's body size, it's an electronic viewfinder, it's an LCD that has some versatility. Those are at the top of my pyramid. And then, of course, we work down through all the other features that we consider when buying a new camera. I really want to thank all of our Inner Circle members for contributing to this story. And if you have some thoughts that you want to share, there's two places you can do it. You can do it on our Facebook page, the Digital Story Facebook page, where I'll post this podcast. Or if you're an Inner Circle member, you can comment on the poll. The poll's still open and will remain so. And then read all of the great comments. There's a lot of great comments in there that I wasn't able to get to for this segment. You can read those and add your own. Fun thing to talk about. I think it's really interesting. It's shifting, in my opinion, the priorities that photographers have now for their cameras. And it's not just megapixels anymore. It really isn't. Let's take a look at some news items. I've got to do this one following our story. This is on amateurphotographer.com. And it's just fun. Best compact camera in 2026. Perfect point and shoots for photos and video. I'm just going to give you the list. I have the link in the show notes, and you can read about all the good stuff they say here. But let's just get to the list itself, because this is a fun list. And they have different categories for the compacts. Okay, here we go. Best compact camera overall, according to amateurphotographer.com, is the Fujifilm X106. Best compact camera for street photography, the Ricoh GR4. Best full-frame compact camera, the Leica Q3. Best compact camera for video, the Canon PowerShot V1. Best waterproof camera, the Olympus OM System Tough TG7. Best pocket camera for photogs and vlogging, Canon PowerShot G7X Mark III. Best for image quality, Fujifilm GFX 100 RF. Now, that's a medium format camera, just so you know. Best premium compact zoom, Panasonic Lumix L10. Best travel compact, Panasonic Lumix ZS99 or TZ99. Best ultra slim compact, the Canon IXUS 285HS-A, also known as the PowerShot ELF 360HS-A. Boy, that's a catchy name. Best cheap retro-styled compact, Yashica FXD 100. I'm going to stop right there for a second. Do not buy that camera. That camera should not be on this list. It's just not a quality machine. Best compact camera for fun, Camp Snap 2. And best cheap compact camera, the Kodak PixPro FZ45. So there is your list of compact cameras according to amateurphotographer.com. Links in the show notes. You can get in there and review all of them. They have pictures, they have pros and cons, they've got basic specifications. Pretty good stuff if you're browsing compact cameras right now. Sony wants to buy Tamron. Nikon and Canon shooters should pay attention. This is an article that's on DP Review. Link is in the show notes. Photography and consumer electronics giant Sony has offered to buy Tamron, a company well known for its lenses and optics. This would be, to put it mildly, a massive shakeup in the photography markup that could end up having profound impacts on the lenses available to photographers using other systems in the coming years. So what's happening here? According to a statement Tamron made to investors, Sony has made a non-binding proposal that would result in Tamron being a wholly owned subsidiary of Sony Group Corporation. Tamron says it set up a special committee to review the proposal, but that it currently has nothing else to disclose. One of the most important things to glean from that statement is that, according to Tamron, it would end up as a subsidiary of Sony. That implies that, at least at the beginning, it would still exist as a separate entity. Keep that in mind. It'll be important later on in the discussion. Why does Sony want to buy Tamron? There are several potential reasons for Sony wanting to acquire Tamron, not all of which have to do with photography. While the majority, 74.2% in 2023 of Tamron sales, come from its photographic products, the company's surveillance, automation, mobility, and healthcare divisions also make millions of dollars each year. Sony's a big player in those spaces too. While most of us are familiar with Tamron because of its camera lenses, we shouldn't discount the possibility that those other businesses play a part too. With that said, Sony told Reuters that its reasoning for the offer is because it thinks the acquisition would be good for Tamron shareholders and that it could help Sony's imaging business as well. That seems to mean that the company's photography business is one of the main draws for Sony. So what happens if Sony buys Tamron? Neither company has commented yet on what will happen if the deal actually goes through, but there are a few possible scenarios that are worth exploring should it happen. Scenario 1. Tamron continues on with business as usual. Scenario 2. Tamron still exists, but only makes lenses for Sony. Scenario 3. Tamron disappears into the behemoth. Now, I'm just reading the subheads for that. Then the article goes on and explains what they mean by each of those scenarios, okay? So you can read that on your own. Let's get to this. What does this mean for photographers? If the deal ends up going through, the impact on photographers will depend heavily on which path Sony chooses to take. But even if it went with the first option and mostly let Tamron be, that path wouldn't be set in stone. Sony could at any time decide to cut out other companies' access to Tamron lenses and manufacturing, an outcome that wasn't previously on the table. While there are exceptions, consolidation in an industry with already limited number of players isn't typically in the best interest of the consumer. While it may be, as others have argued, a great option for Sony, that doesn't mean it would be good for the camera market overall. All right, well, we will see what happens here. I think we are definitely in wait and see mode. Speaking of DP review, I was interested in this because this is a camera that I'm waiting to receive my review copy of so I can test it. And the Sony RX10 Mark V modernizes everything but its sensor performance. Does it matter? This is an article on DP Review. I have the link in the show notes. I'm sort of curious of what they have to say here. It's undeniable that, in terms of the tech and experience around its sensor, the Sony RX10 Mark V is an excellent example of how far the camera industry has come over the last 10 or so years when compared to the Sony RX10 Mark IV from 2017. But during that time, we've also seen a lot of discussion around how image quality has stagnated, and there's no obvious difference between the 5's 20 megapixel type 1 stacked CMOS sensor and the 4's. There's some truth to the idea that gains in image quality are coming slower these days, and that much of the past decade's progress has been more focused on performance in aspects like autofocus and readout speeds. That's not to say there have been no advances in image quality, but Sony hasn't bragged about including them in the RX10 Mark V. The only real way to find out, though, is to put it in front of our test scene. And that's exactly what they did here. Our test scene is designed to simulate a variety of textures, colors, and detail types that you'll encounter in the real world. It also has two illumination modes, full, even light, and low directional light, to see the effect of different lighting conditions. Unsurprisingly, the RX10 Mark V performs very similarly to the RX10 Mark IV when looking at its raw images at base ISO, which is a good thing. It captures a good amount of detail at 88 millimeters equivalent. Its lens actually holds up quite well compared to other cameras with Type 1 sensors and lenses with much less ambitious focal lengths. It also provides more detail with less noise than the Nikon P1000, which offers much more reach but uses lower res and much smaller 16 megapixel 1/2-inch sensor. The RX10 Mark V JPEGs are where a decade of progress becomes apparent. The colors are much more pleasing than those of the 4, with more natural skin tones and the vibrancy of colors turned up where they were lacking and turned down when they were overbearing. We also found this to be the case with the sample photos we shot with the 5. Sony's progress out on this front has been slow and steady, but with so much time between the two models, it's much more noticeable. So in summary, the RX10 Mark V doesn't represent a massive shift in terms of image quality from its predecessor, nor indeed the RX10 Mark III and the RX10 Mark II before it, which both use similarly spec'd sensors. When those cameras were released, we called their image quality excellent. However, it's hard to ignore the images from smartphones armed with increasingly sophisticated computational photography tricks have been getting better and better. Some models even include Type 1 sensors too, edging in on even the highest-end enthusiast compacts. If only in terms of image quality and not shooting experience, arguably, the RX10 Mark V with this massive focal range is one of the compacts most insulated from this, as phones' telephotos are often paired with much smaller sensors and don't offer anywhere near the level of reach. But it does raise questions about how next versions of cameras like the RX100 will differentiate themselves. Going back to the camera at hand, though, regardless of how much the RX10 Mark V has or hasn't improved when it comes to imaging, it's still the best in its class, even if it's the only pupil remaining. Okay, interesting stuff there. I think that, though, they do touch on one thing that I really like, which is the imaging pipeline. And I went through this a little bit with the L10 also, which has basically the same lens as the LX100 had, that Leica zoom lens. And the differences really I've noticed are coming from that Panasonic's imaging pipeline for the L10 is really improved over previous models. And that's something that has changed over the years. So the question is, do you really need to change out the sensor itself or everything that you do in between the sensor and, you know, what actually goes on the memory card? Does that count for more or at least have a big impact on the final images? I think that imaging pipeline is a big deal, and I think that the RX10 Mark V is probably an example of that. I think the L10 is also an example of that, and it's probably going to be a trend that we see, especially for non-flagship cameras that don't require the best of the best. Let's face it, those sensors from a decade ago were pretty darn good. And that also means that if we wanted to, we could pull out our 8-year-old camera, take pictures of it, and we're probably not giving up much. Interesting article on DP Review. All right, let's take care of a little virtual camera club news. We're going to start out with workshops again. Two workshops coming up. We've got the Lightroom workshop coming up starting on September 9th. And then we have in November our inkjet printing workshop. You can sign up for both of those workshops by going to the workshops page either on the digitalstory.com or the nimblephotographer.com. Hope to see you there. I'd like to acknowledge our Inner Circle members, the folks that provided us with such excellent content for today's podcast. And they do that week after week through their various conversations, sharing their pictures, responding to polls, showing up for workshops, and just being all around, in general, very interesting people. If you'd like to join our inner circle, which I highly recommend, I think you'll have a blast. All you have to do is click on the Patreon tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story. You can sign up there. I'll then get you set up with all the goodies, and you can start enjoying the wonderful camaraderie that we have with this fantastic community. And a big thanks to our Inner Circle members for supporting this podcast. And finally, I'd like to give a tip of the lens cap to Red River Paper, longest running sponsor of the Digital Story. We're getting to that time of year now where we're accumulating pictures. We have pictures from our spring trips. We probably maybe even had a summer trip now. We're working on various projects. Maybe we have a new camera. Who knows all the wonderful things that are going on. The thing that I want to add to the equation is, as you identify your really fantastic photos, the ones that you like so much, then don't just leave them on your computer. I mean, it's a great place to store our images. It's even a great place to share them at times. It's wonderful to pull out the smartphone and show your wonderful landscape shot on this little screen. Or, if you wanted, you could make a nice, luxurious 11 by 14 inch print or a 13 by 19 inch print using Red River paper, nice and big, mat it up, hang it on the wall, and then let people walk up to it and just enjoy it on their terms. They can stand to the side, they can put their nose against the glass, they can step back and just admire the beauty of it, but they can experience the photo more the way that they want to experience the photo. Plus, you have some control with lighting and ambiance and how you set it up. It's really just a great way to show off your best work. And if you're interested in pursuing that, just click on the Red River paper tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story. Nose around a bit, get yourself some paper, read some articles, and start making some great artwork from your work. People will love it, I promise you. And a big thanks to Red River Paper for supporting this podcast. All right, it's going to do it for me this week. I hope you enjoyed the show, working on more great stuff for next week. Until then, get out there, take some pictures, stay safe. See you next Tuesday. Bye-bye now.